Thanks for joining us. My name is Ibrahim Sani. Tonight, we are going to be looking at some of the elements when it comes to the Economy Madani plan that was presented by the Prime Minister last week. But of course, before that, we have to look into the second half outlook and see what is in store for us for the next 5 months towards the end of 2023. Joining us online is Suhaimi Ilyas, the Group Economist over at Maybank Group. Suhaimi, thanks for joining us. I just want to do a quick look into the kind of ideas that we need to expect for the next 5 months to come and perhaps the second half outlook for this year, knowing that July has closed. What can we see from the economy right now?
Hi, Ibrahim. Thanks for having me here today. I think for the Malaysian economy, our full year 2023 forecast is growth easing or moderating to 4.5%, down from 8.7% last year. So obviously last year was good year in terms of growth because of the full opening impact on the economy. But I think this year there will be some moderation, largely because of the base effect on growth. Certainly second quarter and third quarter GDP this year will reflect that base effect quite materially, because second quarter and third quarter last year, our economic growth shot up to 9% and 14% respectively. That's not the kind of number we're going to see quarter in, quarter out. Aside from base effect, of course, we have to acknowledge the fact that global economy is moderating. We are looking at global growth to ease to 2.7% from 3.5% last year because of the downturn in US economy, stagnation or recession in Europe. China's economic opening impact is not as strong as we have been expecting or anticipating. So that is having an impact on our economy through trade channel. And thirdly, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that our economy is going through this process of feeling the impact of the cumulative 125 basis point increase in the overnight policy rate, or OPR, by Bank Negara between May last year and May this year. But Ibrahim, having said that, acknowledging these headwinds on the economy, I think we have to also acknowledge the fact that there are buffers, there are tailwinds to the economy as well. So the 4.5% growth reflect cross-current between the headwinds and tailwinds. What are the tailwinds? I think obviously the major tailwinds would be the recovery in tourism economy, as well as I think the other thing that's also worth highlighting is I think investment growth momentum is actually positive, taking cue from the trend in lead indicator on investment, i.e. the approved investment statistics. So what I find interesting is that our approved total private sector investment since 2021 has been very robust, very strong. 10 years before 2021, we were chalking around, you know, 180, 190 billion ringgit per annum private sector approval in terms of investment. But it went slightly above 300 billion in 2021. Last year was still robust at around 265 billion. First quarter of this year, solid number of 70 billion, which is about 35% increase year on year from first quarter of last year. So the momentum is still there. What is interesting about this robust private investment approval statistics is that it's driven by both FDI and domestic direct investment, DDI. FDI has been certainly strong over the past 2 years and continue to remain robust in the first quarter of this year, because we are still, you know, attracting FDI, particularly in the technology sector. I mean, not just electronics, but stuff like data centers, cloud and web services, and so on. And certainly news flows of late also has been positive, with news about, you know, Tesla coming in. And what is also interesting and important to note is domestic direct investment, in my opinion, is at inflection point. So last sort of decade, it has been on a bit of a structural or secular decline, but it has been stable at just over 100 billion ringgit per annum last 3 years. And first quarter of this year, Ibrahim, very interesting, it doubled from 17 billion in first quarter of this year to 37 billion in the first quarter of this year. So almost 100% increase, actually. So it seems to me domestic direct investment approval is on inflection point, which I think augurs well for overall investment growth momentum, because domestic direct investment is also sort of turning the corner after, you know, being in the doldrum for the better part of the last decade and the early part of this decade. And what is interesting, I think that domestic direct investment is going to be supported and driven by, you know, interesting development, particularly in the areas of, you know, logistics, in the areas of you know, domestic players also going into the data centers business, together with, you know, developments in solar farms, for example. And okay, one last point I want to make, Ibrahim, before I stop. We also think in the remaining months of this year, Bank Negara is done in terms of OPR hike. We don't see any changes to current 3% OPR level. And I think two things help Bank Negara's decision on that. One is inflation is coming down. It's already sub 3% since May. And secondly, I think the situation with Ringgit has, in a way, improved. Ringgit has stabilized.
The government identified 9 major structural challenges facing our economy right now. Some of them include governance or the deterioration of it. We're looking at being domestically driven, low labor share of income, and many more. Your top line, I guess, assessment in terms of the Madani economy, were you impressed by the plan, or do you feel that this is more of the same?
I think, Ibrahim, having plan is better than no plan at all. So I think this is an important sort of a starting point for the government of the day in terms of having a narrative and framework for our economic path next decade. I think it's also very important that in addressing the challenges that you mentioned just now, I think this Madani economic narrative and framework essentially aims to do two things. One is raise the ceiling for the economy. Second is raise the floor for the people. So it's not just about, you know, achieving, for example, upliftment in our real GDP growth to, let's say, I think what was mentioned by Prime Minister in his speech during the launch of Madani economy is seeking to raise the pace of economic growth to 5.5 to 6% per annum over the next 10 years against current run rate or business as usual growth of 4% to 5%. But you also see that attempt to make sure that the growth and development of the economy next decade is also inclusive. It's also equal, have some notion of equality. So that's why, for example, I think another interesting sort of target next 10 years that the government set is to raise the workers' share of GDP to 45% by, I guess, 2033, and also raising it to 40% by 2025 against the current numbers of around 32%. So I think, apart from that, I think in the end, this is about providing a better Malaysia that also benefits the people.
The main issue of the day is, of course, wages. And a lot has been said about the progressive wage model that the economy minister, Rafizi, is propagating. What is the House view of Maybank right now when it comes to progressive wage model versus minimum wage?
I think, obviously, this is a bit of an upliftment in terms of the nature of our wage and salary growth going forward. Minimum wage address certain issues in terms of providing a floor for people to have, in a way, decent income and decent living. But I think the spirit of a progressive wage model is essentially to have a wage and system or income system that I think recognize the productivity contribution of workers, that also try to incentivize both employers and employees to, you know, constantly improve productivity through reskilling, upskilling, retraining, learning for life concepts, and so on. So I think it's very important for us to be clear that the progressive wage model is not about just being, you know, simply socialist in terms of giving a greater share of GDP to workers, but the process of giving or producing greater share of workers to the economy is rooted essentially on productivity. And I think that's the most important message that we must bear in mind.
There's also non-financial targets like improving perception index on graft, improving governance, trying to attract more, talent coming in. These are complementary targets to have. And if I would like to argue, it's a little bit more lofty, even though it's a medium-term target of 10 years. Do you feel that it comes hand in hand, these financial targets of economic growth versus non-financial targets that can actually complement or in fact drive these economic growth?
I think in particular, the issue of governance is extremely important. I think as mentioned by Prime Minister, I think one of the key challenges facing the country is the deterioration in governance. And obviously that is reflected by how we have basically slipped down the ranking, the poll in terms of the Global Corruption Perception Index. And obviously, the government set a target to kind of restore our image on that front. I think over the next 10 years, wanting to improve our position or ranking in the Corruption Perception Index from, I think, current position 61, 62 to top 25. I think why this is important is because I think things like corruption, graft, it affect the economy, particularly in terms of cost of doing business and ultimately filter into cost of living for the people. All these leakages, I think, just represent inefficiency. It's also result in a situation where we have a sizable or at least worryingly a persistence in black economy. And the country lost in that sense because of the leakages, because of the non-payment of revenues, wastages and all that. So I think this has to be put to stop. And I think if that can be done, definitely it will help also in terms of our competitiveness ranking. I think that's the intention of Prime Minister when he talked about these issues and make it as one of the key elements in his Madani economy narrative and framework for the next 10 years.
Where do you see the engines of growth in achieving these targets? Like I said, financial targets and these non-financial targets of corruption and competitiveness and all the other stuff that we spoke about, governance. Where is the growth? Is it from the MSME sector? Is it from, I don't know, startup sector? Is it from our large corporates driving growth further? Where do you see the growth coming from?
I think the key word here, Ibrahim, is investment. I mean, one of the challenges that structural issues that Prime Minister said in his speech was the declining share of investment in GDP. So obviously, investment would be a key factor in achieving those, what you said as lofty or ambitious target. I think
is political risk the inhibiting factor here for investment coming in, either FDI or DDI? Are we mitigating that political risk notion right now?
I think maybe there's some perception that the situation concerning our politics for the last 4 or 5 years has been a factor. But as I said at the start earlier, the trend in investment approval stated or indicating otherwise. So I think that's very interesting, despite the concerns about the body politics of the country. But I think what is need to be recognized here as well is that the policy making body of the country are still functioning. And because of that, you see last few years, FDI has been robust and we are seeing a prospect of inflection point in our domestic direct investment. I think the other thing I want to highlight is that right after the announcement of Madani economy in the morning of 27 July, in the afternoon, immediately we have this National Energy Transition Roadmap Part 1 that is obviously launched together by Ministry of Economy and Ministry of Natural Resources, Environment and Climate Change. And this is also done together with, you know, the banking industries and the capital market players. I think that's very interesting because we have example of how we don't work in silos anymore. There is this all of Malaysian approach in terms of dealing with this issue. And I find the energy transition roadmap interesting because obviously there's going to be a lot of sort of investment themes in that segment. I mean, minimally, Ibrahim, just to basically ensure that we achieve our net zero target by 2050, we're talking about nearly half a trillion ringgit investment over the next 30 years. So that's basically, in my calculation, could add to GDP growth by 1 percentage point. So in that sense, from our BAU of 4 to 5%, we already get one extra percentage point to GDP growth by, you know, being able to implement the National Energy Transition Roadmap. Obviously, this is the way forward. This is the future of industry. It's not so much about coming up with new business or growth drivers, but transitioning one of the key part of our economy, the energy sector, over the next you know, 3 decades, and the investment growth in terms of minimum requirement just to achieve net zero by 2050 is substantial in terms of its contribution to GDP growth.
Part of the cost controlling measures is to subsidize carbon. Right now, Malaysia is still subsidizing carbon. How does that play into the green energy transition policy right now, Suhaimi? Are we going to see a reduction in the subsidization of petroleum right now?
It's an ongoing process. I think this year the story has been about, you know, implementing targeted electricity subsidies. You have seen how industries in particular that are high users and high voltage, medium voltage users, as well as, I suppose, the ultra rich, not going to get the benefit of electricity subsidies. On petroleum or fuel subsidy, I think what has happened this year is more to do with addressing leakages, particularly in the areas of diesel subsidies, as well as this business of, you know, foreign vehicles taking advantage of our cheap petrol. So I think that's the focus this year. But next year, definitely we're going to see the expansion of the targeted fuel subsidies from electricity to fuel. I have to admit, it's still a black box in terms of information as to the mechanics, the timing, the quantum, and so on. But I think we will wait for the announcement of budget 2024 on 13th of October for some clarity, some information, some picture in terms of how the targeted fuel subsidy is going to take place. But I think definitely that must happen so that our overall green transition makes sense by, you know, incentivizing and allocating more the move towards renewable energy, and disincentivizing and giving less allocation progressively for, you know, fossil fuel based sort of subsidies.
Okay, two more areas before conclude our conversation. The first of the two areas is infrastructure projects. That's going to drive any economy, including ours, of course. I'm looking at some of the notes here that you shared: MRT3, Penang LRT, Johor Bahru Rapid Transit, Subang Airport, Penang Airport. Nothing in the terms of Sabah, Sarawak. And I find that, I don't know, strange, considering that Indonesia is moving to Nusantara. Wouldn't you want to be developing that side of Malaysia?
I don't think there's nothing going on. Obviously, there are ongoing projects there. The biggest, of course, is the Pan Borneo Highway. And I understand that there are perhaps discussion at Sarawak, maybe Sabah, Sarawak states level, together with maybe the authorities in Indonesia about potentially improving the connectivity between, you know, the two states of the country with the upcoming Nusa Jaya capital in Kalimantan. But I think maybe at the same time, perhaps the issue for that part of the country is also the need to continuing with the improvement in basic infrastructure. As we know, still a challenge there, number one. And I think number two, that part of the country also, I think, would going forward play a big role in terms of renewable energy future for Malaysia, particularly in the case of hydrogen segment that is also being talked about in the National Energy Transition Roadmap. And I think Sarawak is already making a move on that in terms of hydrogen aspect of our renewable energy transition. And I think, Ibrahim, maybe we should also start kind of easing down in terms of our thinking that infrastructure must be everything physical, you know, road, bridges, transport, airports, blah, blah, blah. I think we need to think about energy infrastructure, renewable energy infrastructure. There's a lot going on in this space. And I said earlier, as per the estimate of the basic minimum requirement for investment to achieve our net zero by 2050, almost half a trillion next 30 years, it can contribute easily to additional 1 percentage point growth to GDP.
All right, you're right. Noted on that whole brick and mortar notion of infrastructure building. Before we move on to the second part of the 2 points I want to touch on, the hydrogen idea of Sarawak, do you feel that that is going to be one of the more contentious points in terms of development for the Sarawak region? And do you feel that that is an area that both the federal government and Sarawak will definitely intensify, i.e. putting more money inside it, trying to get more people for it, trying to bring technologies to develop it further? Is that the exciting bit that we can expect from the Mandani economy for Sarawak?
I think certainly, because I think the whole thing just boils down to the fact that we need to start strategizing going forward, because as we know, oil and gas are finite resources. And as we know, so right now, before we go full on renewable energy, gas will play a key role. So I guess the transition momentum have to be further built upon. So I guess we are in the sweet spot in terms of gas play, but I think definitely we have to strategize for a broader contribution of renewable energy to our energy mix. As you know, the target is very clear. From where we are now, we want to hit 40% by 2035 and 70% by 2050. Definitely, the journey must start now. And I think another interesting thing is that if we look at our sort of natural gas or LNG exports right now, obviously going to the Northeast Asian clients like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, these guys are also looking into progressively turning the economy to go more on renewable energy. So question is, what is our offering? So obviously, I think from that perspective, given that we already have the hydrocarbon source, I guess the issue now is looking at how to take advantage of that, you know, our basic or intrinsic strength in terms of those natural resources to come up with a new source of energy. And I guess together with stuff like solar, hydrogen is the answer. And I suppose, and I believe actually the likes of Japan is looking seriously into this. So we must make sure that we are prepared for the eventual demand that is coming our way on that front. And I think also we must make sure that we are prepared for that, because you know the government have just lifted the ban on renewable energy exports. I mean, we can lift the ban, but do we have the products? So I think we have to prepare on that basis.
Okay. As promised, the final area of concern that I want to explore with you is on execution risk. We saw all these plans long-term in nature, yeah, Mandani Economy 10-year roadmap. We're looking at the National Energy Transition Roadmap, NETER, the National Industry Master Plan by 2030, and of course, the South Malaysia Plan, National Automotive Plan, all this. We're looking at all these plans, long-term horizon, but so many things are happening at a rapid pace. The disruption is going to happen at record speed. Do you feel that these kind of roadmaps can actually entertain the kind of disruption that is happening at a daily basis right now? And how does this tie with the execution risk? It's nice to have these plans. Everybody wants to head in the right direction. But can it be done considering that Malaysia has been lousy in terms of its execution?
I acknowledge the fact, the issues that, you know, we are extremely good when it comes to, you know, dishing up plans, master plans, blueprint, roadmaps, so on and so forth. The challenge is always on execution. So I guess maybe one thing that would be good to have alongside all these, you know, business of being busy in the second half of this year in dishing out all those plan, roadmaps, blueprints is some sort of one-stop center or central coordinating body to basically monitor, audit, and provide high-frequency, regular updates of what's going on. Something that is akin, in my opinion, to what we had last time, the performance management and delivery unit, Pemandu. I think having something like that would be good in terms of being enabling not just the government itself, but also investors and people to have what I said as a regular high frequency update in terms of what's going on. Tracking this is very important.
Talking about tracking, I have here a nice chart of yours It's called the Malaysia's Economic Journey, moving from what we were as a commodity-based economy to an industrial-based economy, that we need to culminate into our current status as an upper-middle-class economy. Do you feel that that transition is where we need to be moving forward, that we are heading in the right direction from commodity to industrial to export-oriented to services and rapid diversification of premature deindustrialization? Are we on the right track, you know, so to speak?
I think we are, in the sense that I think the ultimate aim here is to, number one, maintain the diversified nature of our economy. We are not trying to reinvent the wheel here, really, to come up with, you know, a completely unheard of new growth drivers. We are just want to leverage on our intrinsic inherent strength, ecosystem, and so on, to make sure that we go to the next level. Like I said, when it comes to energy, we are obviously a major player benefiting in terms of exports of fossil fuel, fossil-based energy. We just want to move on to RE that is being, I think, implemented by the government. Similarly, when it comes to automotive manufacturing, we have the ecosystem, but it's ICE-based. We just want to move to EV-based. And when it comes to EV, there's a whole lot of things that need to be done. It's not just a case of bringing in the cars, but also whether we can be part of the global EV supply chain in terms of parts and components for EV, and also to drive the adoption of EV. What is the thing that we want to do in terms of, you know, charging infrastructure, in terms of incentives, to basically get people on board on this transition. Similarly, when it comes to electronics, I think the beauty of our electronics industry or E&E industries over the past 50 years, they constantly evolve. You know, from producing white goods 50 years ago, we are right now in the supply chain for smart devices. And I think going forward, we have to make sure, and I do hope International Industrial Master Plan that's coming up next month will also provide an outline in terms of strategy of how we're going to benefit from the AI.
There you go. Thank you very much, Suhaimi, for joining us. Any parting words before we conclude conversation? Short one.
Well, I really, again, want to repeat what I said earlier. I think it's all good in terms of coming up with the plans, blueprint, master plan, but I do feel very important also this to be accompanied by, you know, high frequency regular update in terms of what's going on, so we can keep track, and that would that flow of information, I think, would provide credibility to our journey over the next 10 years.
Thank you very much. That was Suhaimi Ilyas, the Chief Economist at Maybank Group. Thanks for joining us for this evening.